So this is the first chapter of my new novel, All the Wind in the World. The goal is to get to the heart. Slash off the spines, sever the bulb from the roots, move down the row. There are other steps to the Magay harvest, but I'm responsible for only those three. There are men who drive the trucks, and there are kids who jump down from the beds of those trucks to load up the hearts, which, once shorn of their spines, are the color of milk and roughly the size and shape of medicine balls. The hearts are then taken to factories by train, where they're roasted and mashed until they produce a heavy, smoky sweet liquid. That liquid, when distilled, becomes pulque, mezcal, or if you are rich, tequila as clear as a tear. It's morning. I'm on my way to the fields when I hear a whistle from a passing train. The sound hits the mountains and hums a ragged tune across the plain. We tell time by whistles. 7:10 in the morning westbound, 9:22 in the morning eastbound, 2:20 in the afternoon westbound. We know it takes 10 minutes at a steady run to the south-southeast to get to those tracks from camp. We've timed it. The truck I'm riding in starts to slow and pulls alongside several others just like it, all crammed with workers. We clutch the long handles of our koas, hop down from the truck, and take our places in front of a row of spiky plants that seem to disappear in either direction into the orange-hued horizon. A gust of wind comes through, carrying with it a strange smell, something like sulfur mixed with citrus fruit. "I'm surprised how late you slept, Sarah." My heart lurches, then yanks itself back into place. James has snuck up behind me enough times in my life that he shouldn't cause this kind of reaction, yet somehow he still does. I turn to see him standing no more than a foot away, his eyes glinting, much like the blade of his koa does in the desert sun. I can tell he's worried about me, just on the edge of frustrated. When he gets this way, which is often enough, the brilliant moss-green color of his eyes comes out. "No, you're not," I reply. "I thought maybe you wouldn't make it out." "No," I flashed James a grin. "You didn't." We're surrounded by other Himidors, so we're talking in code. I'd rather we not be talking at all. I'd rather it be like last night late, when it was just the two of us on the outskirts of camp, out in the scrub grass under the harvest moon, when the only sounds coming from James's mouth were the syllables of my name broken by sighs. "No," James says. "I didn't." He glances at my blade. As usual, I woke up late, and as a result, I'm stuck with a dull tool. "The sun's not even all the way up, but it looks like you've already run out of luck for the day," he says. "I'll trade you if you want." "Please," I scoff. "I could cut more Magay than you with a butter knife." James laughs, which is wonderful. He does this automatic thing where he lowers his head and covers his mouth with his hand like he's embarrassed. He is embarrassed. There's a scar at the left edge of his upper lip, the result of a dog biting him when he was a kid, way before we met. Whenever he laughs or smiles wide, his lip tugs up a bit, like it's being sewn with a needle. It's hardly anything, but to James, it's conspicuous. Sometimes I think there's so much sameness in the desert. The bunkhouses are the same peanut shell color as the dirt. The dirt is the same color as the mountains. Most days, the sky is striking in its clear blue, but there are a few birds that fly through it, and the ones that do are black. Our long days are reiterations of the long days that came before. It's tough to tell young from old or man from woman because the desert has a way of erasing the things that make us each unique. Flying grit scrapes away at our faces. The wind tries to knock us flat, and the sun tries to bleach us, dry us out, turn us into dust. All the wind and dirt, it doesn't scrape away at James. It polishes him to a shine. He's alive out here. He stands taller. His eyes shine brighter. I lean forward, as if to dive into those eyes. He leans forward, pretending to examine the nicks on my koa blade. We've done a version of this thousands of times, hovering whisper close to each other. But each time the feeling is new and thrilling, like snatching something from a store shelf or trying to outrun the rain. Another whistle blows, this one just near my right ear and certainly not from a train, and James and I fly apart just as one of the foremen jerks his chestnut brown mare to a stop alongside us. "James Holt," the foreman barks. "You think you and your cousin get paid to stand here and admire the weather?" And James snorts. What's biting you, Angus? New horse causing you trouble? It is a new horse. A sorrel I've never seen before. She's twitchy, obviously uneasy. She tosses her head, her nostrils flaring as she sniffs the sulfur-tinted air. She shuffles forward, then back. Angus responds by gripping the reins and pulling hard. The horse squeals as the bit pulls against her gums. You're too rough with her, I say. Too rough, Angus yanks again. The horse squeals, then stills long enough for the foreman to lean down and level his eyes with mine. You haven't seen how rough I can get with the girls who piss me off. He grins, revealing a jagged row of gray teeth. Now get moving.